Some 5.5 million Americans are college students. Among these young men and women, and some not so young, you will find every shade of attitude and of ability. Some are dandies, and some delight in being disheveled. A few are great conscious, and far more are boy crazy and girl crazy. Some jeer at the lonely figure of a Negro on his way to class, and others spend their summer in Mississippi building churches and registering voters. There has been tumult on most American campuses, parades and picketing and megaphone protest. This tumult, this shouting deserves our interest, but even as we concern ourselves with it, let us remember that it is a minority who have marched and studied in, that the closest that the majority of the students have come to a demonstration is the annual football rally. There is a rebellious equanimity among most of these young people. Columnist Jules Feiffer cartooned the mood of today's campus, the mood which does not make the headlines, in a strip which showed a gangly, fidgety sophomore seated across the desk from his faculty advisor. The advisor speaks. "Roger, it's my job to ask you, what do you want out of life?" "Well, sir, when I get out of school, I'd like a job that doesn't have to be great or anything, and without too much responsibility, a job that I could stay in for the rest of my life. And after a year or two, I'd like to pick one of the girls I've been dating and marry her. She doesn't have to be a knockout or anything, but I'd like her to make a good appearance in front of the guys where I work and my friends. And if she can keep a home, so much the better. Not a big home, mind you, maybe 3 or 4 bedrooms, a workshop, a garage, a TV, and a stereo, and for my wife, a washer and dryer, and a kid, if I get a promotion. And we'll live in the same neighborhood with the guys I go to school with, so every once in a while I can meet them someplace and have somebody to talk to. That's it, I guess. But you know me, sir. I'm an idealist." President Clark Kerr, of the most restless of the campuses, the University of California, observed some 6 years ago of that generation of students that employers would take great delight in them. They would be very easy to handle. This past fall and winter, 800 of Dr. Kerr's students have been arrested for disturbing the peace, for bringing his campus and the nearby community to a virtual standstill. There are a growing number of students who are not easy to handle. But by far, the vast majority remain tractable, driven on by a profound nesting instinct, much more concerned with how far a college education will stretch their earning power than how far an education might stretch their reasoning powers and their understanding, and quite convinced that this world which they never made is, in most things, in practically all things, the best of all possible worlds. To be sure, there are more porcupines today, but there are fully as many rabbits. And so, though we might believe that a few of the young people need to be reined in and domesticated, I still have the feeling that I'd like to reach out and shake most of them awake and convince them that there's more to life than a steady job and a split-level home, Saturday night out, and Social Security. That beyond the gentle virtues and the gentle vices, There's a surging, exciting, pulsating world filled with high adventure, with overarching opportunity, and with profound responsibility. And that it's a tragedy to walk as a mummy, dead, in this bright, wonderful world of ours. Now, Joe College is a familiar and rather amiable, if dull, feature and fixture of the university scene. The young rebel, bearded, disheveled, with too tight trousers or slacks, something new. He has cried out stridently for our attention, and he deserves our attention. It all began, as you know, in Berkeley, where in the fall of the year, thousands of protesting students literally brought that campus to an absolute standstill. At issue was a university decision rescinding the privilege of political organizations, protest organizations, to use a certain square of pavement near one of the main gates as a place for advertisement, for meeting, for the enlistment of support, and to get funds. Causes varied from campus to campus, but hardly a major university remained without its demonstration. At Yale, during the year, students marched long into the night to protest the refusal of tenure to a popular associate professor of philosophy. At St. John's in New York City, the students demonstrated against what they called the paternalism of the clerical administration. At nearby Oberlin, the issue was a very serious one indeed. A parietal rule which insisted that if girl visitors were in the men's dormitory rooms, they had to keep the door so many inches ajar. The faculty said 4 inches, the student body said 2. At the University of Syracuse, thousands turned out to convince the chancellor that he ought to add 3 days to the midwinter vacation. There is a new confidence, a new assertiveness, a new sense of power, and even in many cases a new maturity in today's college population. You remember how in 1945 and 1946, when the hardened and disciplined veterans came back to the campus, they managed for a while to erase most of the tinsel, the rah-rah of pre-war days. Well, in many ways, we have a new generation of veterans on our campus. The veterans of the war on poverty, the veterans of the war on race, the returnees from the Peace Corps. And these young people have gone out into the depths of our society, into the reaches of our world. They went out docile, burdened only by a concern with the American promise, and they came back assertive, ready to put themselves on the line, impatient, determined to do away with what they felt were grievances now, not to be put off by promises, by words. They wanted proof, and they wanted it now. The young people who've spent their winters working 3-4 afternoons a week in the center city slums. The young people who went down into the South, who heeded the call of Dr. Martin Luther King and the other civil rights leaders. The young people who listened to President Kennedy and joined up for a year or two of service across the seas. These young people are now on our campuses. And they're no longer wet behind the ears. They're no longer young. There's a maturity and a hard determination and impatience and a citizenship which the colleges have not known for 2 decades now. These young people are prepared to protest for the redress of what they consider to be unfortunate and unwarranted grievance. What are these grievances? They vary. Largely, they deal with the fact that the universities tend to treat our young people, the adults of 20, 21, and 22, as if they were young teenagers, early adolescents. They're all manner of faculty student committee. Democracy insists that we operate through committees, and good education insists that you listen to what the young people, the students, are asking so that your courses and the student program responds to their needs. But on most campuses, these faculty student committees are window dressing, sham, a public relations gimmick so that predetermined administrative decisions can be easily passed down through and accepted by the student body. On most campuses, the young people are told to abide by check-ins and by curfews far stricter than any they know in their homes, if indeed their homes still insist on such rules. The grievances vary, but behind them, at the base of it all, lies a simple, unfortunate truth, and it is this. But on the modern academic campus, the young scholar is taught, but he's no longer educated. On the modern American campus, the young scholar is an IBM card. Series of holes, date of admission, dormitory, tuition, courses, grades, probable date of graduation. He's no longer treated as a person. It's entirely possible for a young man or woman to receive his AB degree after 4 years of study and not to have spent a single hour in a discussion or a seminar with a single senior member of the university. Most teaching is being done today by graduate assistants and instructors, but a year or two older than the student body. I saw recently in Newsweek magazine the photograph of a freshman class in psychology at the University of Minnesota. You may have seen it. There was a high platform in the room, a single professor speaking into a microphone to 2,000 students. The young people today are being educated by television, by programmed learning, by mass lectures, by arbitrary library assignments, but there's no meeting of the minds. They're housed, to be sure, in student compounds, where they meet adults, to be sure, experts in diet, experts in discipline, non-academic people. The university was once a place where able and trained minds reacted upon able and eager minds, the untrained. And out of that clash and that spark and that tension, there was growth for the adult and for the young adult. Today, our universities are knowledge factories in which the student is, by and large, the raw material who will be turned out at the end of 4 years, a competent technician, capably apprenticed to his economic role. But he will not be more competent than when he entered as a citizen. And there will have been little concern for his competence as philosopher, as thinker, as human being. And there are many reasons for this. The colleges could not staff themselves adequately for the student population explosion. And the very time when tens of thousands of new students were descending upon the campus, many of the faculty were withdrawing from the teaching profession. Research has become the drive and the thrust on many a campus and in many a department. Government grants, foundation grants, help to balance out the enormous expenditures of our universities. And so the universities encourage their senior people to apply for grants and to be busy full-time in this research. Many universities promote their young people on the basis of publish or perish. Research, produce new materials, or you will not be promoted. And so it's understandable that these younger faculty members look upon teaching upon the student as an intrusion on his laboratory time or his library time. As the universities have bid for the best of the faculty, for the names in the academic world, these men and women have been able to write their own tickets, and by and large, these are self-indulgent tickets indeed. Yes, they will come to Harvard or to the University of California or to the University of Michigan. And they expect, and quite rightly so, a fine salary. But they expect to be allowed to lead their own lives. Oh, they'll be happy to teach a graduate course in their specialty every 3 or 4 semesters. And yes, if they have a graduate student or two who's working in their special field, they'll guide him towards his doctoral degree. But that's it. Professor on a modern American campus is, by and large, a research specialist, no longer a teacher. So our young people at the university are experiencing daily the dehumanizing element of the population explosion. They know that they are ciphers, numbers, statistics. The University of California, when the protests first broke out, there was a large placard carried by one young lady, with the photograph I remember, which said, "Dear Dr. Kerr, I am number 1743627. Do not bend, mutilate, or spindle. Dear Dr. Kerr, I'm not a number. I'm a human being." Once upon a time, and not so long ago, on many campuses, there was a mingling of faculty and of students, and the mood of the campus was correspondingly mature. As segregation, the segregation of the ages, has taken place on the campus, the mood of the undergraduate who is told to live by himself and with his own has become increasingly juvenile and restless, adolescent and rebellious. A subculture of the undergraduate has come into being. And like all cultures, it has its own politics and its own politicians. It has its own language, it has its own literature, it has even its own music, and most of all, it has its own uniform. Deliberately unconventional. You know it well. Scrawny beard, stubble, stringy hair, no makeup, tennis shoes, slacks that are too tight. As if the young person set out deliberately to break every rule and discipline in which you trained them in your homes. And that, of course, is the whole point of it. For this is a uniform of a group in rebellion. The idiom, the language, the thought, the concerns are critical. Critical of the adult world. Critical of you and of me. And of all that society stands for. Many of you have sat across a dinner table or in your living rooms and heard your own private rebel tick off this criticism. He does it with remarkable dispassion, by the way, as if you're a sociological statistic and not a parent. Mother, father, how can you live the kind of life that you do? His favorite words are shallow, empty, hypocritical. You say you go out to a party and you have a good time, but what happens when you're out? You engage in small talk. And what is small talk but a deliberate walling in of the individual from all that's important and exciting in life? From ideas, from values, from religion, from politics. How can you go along kowtowing and smiling at those that you don't care at all about, for those that you don't respect? You yourself call business a rat race. Why do you stay with it? Aren't you becoming more rodent every year? And it goes on and on. I never know whether we as parents are put off by the ridiculous truth of it all. It tends to hit rather close to the mark to bring to verbal form the ideas which we hardly dare say to ourselves, or whether it's the stubble of hair that bobs up and down in front of our faces as the young prophet of doom speaks our doom. But I would advise us not to be put off by this beatnik uniform. Somehow this uniform has developed all manner of association, is not only that the young person flaunts all in which we take pride, but by wearing this uniform, he seems to be alien, if not altogether wicked. And we see in our eyes sexual aberration, mescaline, drugs, and even perversion. Now, it's true that there are among these young rebels a small group of the pathological. And it's, of course, true that sex is big trouble on today's campus, as it is indeed in all areas of our society. But I doubt seriously whether the young rebel who challenges us about adult hypocrisy, how we are so tolerant of license among our friends and yet demand a discipline of the not so young any longer, which perhaps we ourselves do not abide. I doubt that there is any more actual flaunting of the moralities among these young people than among their well-shaven colleagues of Fraternity Row. Casual liaison is unfortunately a way of life on many segments and in many levels of our society. And these people have simply drawn this adult indulgence to themselves and insisted that what is good for Peyton Place is good in the Harvard Yard. Let us not be put off by the uniform. In many ways, the uniform is only a protective coloration. In many ways, this gives the young person the chance to try out all of the protest, the criticism, what he hears from his peers and from his poets. Here is a chance to lose his identity for a while in another mass, the subculture's mass, so that he can challenge the adults, the values of his home, to see which values are truly his. And his criticism tends to be parrot talk. Half a sociology lecture he has once heard, half the carping criticism of his friends against their parents. It's not so much that he has shattered and broken the values, as that he's searching for values, that he has none. He senses that he's standing on quicksand, and he's looking for new foundations. Don't be put off by the uniform or by the excessive language or by the downright foolishness with which many of these young people express themselves. For there's much in what they say that we ought seriously to listen to. They tell us that we're a smug generation, fat, prosperous, complacent, self-satisfied, and we are. They tell us that we do a lot of talking about citizenship, but most of that talking means only that we insist on the right to do business, to pay minimal taxes, and the privilege of giving a $10 bill here and again to a charity. They hear us talk a good bit about brotherhood once a year, in February, or perhaps they hear us talk a good bit about brotherhood when the young person tells us that he's working 5 days a week in the slum near his school, and we go on at length, very realistically, telling him about all the dangers of walking in and working in the center city. And he hears us do a lot of talking about peace, but it's mostly talk because he knows that when he told us that he was going to Washington to protest with other students, President's massive deterrent policy in Vietnam, we sat him down and tried to lay the law down. There's a great deal of talk and take in our society today. And to be sure there are good citizens, to be sure there are any number of fine human beings who are committed, sacrificially so, to the strengthening, the broadening of our democracy, whose lives are wholly committed to the basic disciplines and values of American society. But how many? And is this young person not saying to us really what the prophet Hosea said to the children of Israel so many centuries ago? O Ephraim, what should I do unto you? O Judah, what should I do unto you? For your goodness is as a summer cloud and as the morning dew that so quick quickly passes away. Our goodness is more verbal than verifiable. Our citizenship concerns are more a smug self-assertion than a sacrificial dedication. And the young person sees the suburban syndrome. He sees many of his parents and many of his parents' friends getting and spending, taking and demanding, insisting and carping, struggling, status-driven. And he criticizes this. This is not the kind of life he wants. This is not the kind of society in which he will immerse himself. And if his criticism began and ended here, as a rabbi, I must perforce say amen. And if his criticism led him to a life of serious service, a life of determined conviction and citizenship, I would champion his every cause. But unfortunately for many of these young people, criticism is beginning and end. They criticize for criticism's sake, and their lives are as complacent as the lives of their parents. They live in a world unto their own, and they act to be left alone in this world. They ask for the privilege of criticism, but they are not prepared to go out and to do, many of them, to be part of life. There is a nihilism, a glorification of the absurd in so much of their thinking. For among this minority of the rebels, it is only a minority who are active in the protest groups, who are active in the center city. The majority sit around, carp and complain in their bar rooms and in their taverns and their beer halls. And tomorrow night they'll sit in the same place, in the same seat, in the same dirt, with the same complaints and the same carping and the same criticism. They glorify some of these young people in the absurd. Let me read to you a bit of a poem. It's actually a blank verse, which was very popular at Berkeley early this year. One of my old friends, of whom I was most fond, was a sane and capable blonde who, except for a habit of taking her own photograph whenever she felt bad, never did anything out of the ordinary until that Sunday when she flipped over a canoe and disappeared in Stowe Lake, surfacing eventually to explain that she had, while holding her breath submerged, experienced a new direction. And consequently, that same night, burned all her pictures, gave me the camera and the key to her flat, and rotating a gay bandana and promising to write, flew calmly off to Cairo without a reservation. Rebellion becomes rebellion for rebellion's sake. It is foolish, they know it. It's a lark. Its very folly is its wisdom. So the rebellion at Berkeley, which began as a concern for the civil rights of students, a serious concern with their constitutional rights, has degenerated over the year into a rude and truculent protest in which the students are insisting on their right to broadcast on the campus radio and to print in the campus paper materials which are laced with the four-letter expletives which our society considers obscene. The subculture has developed a philosophy of its own, and it is a philosophy which begins and ends with the word absurd. Life is absurd. Concern is absurd. Virtue is absurd. Citizenship is absurd. Involvement is absurd. Don't get involved. All they ask is to be left alone, to nourish their own worries, to nurse their own cares, to do the foolish thing. For life is, they agree, a tale full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Now, to burn out the evil from your midst, to be true, not to be hypocritical, to be concerned and committed, these are the elemental religious affirmations. And any criticism which begins with this standard and measures society against this standard is a religiously motivated criticism. When it is criticism for criticism's sake, when virtue itself is denied, when there is no assumed purpose to life, This criticism begins and ends in the denial at all that this pulpit stands for. It becomes a cynicism, a moral nihilism, a moral dead end. And I'm afraid that many of our young people have marooned themselves in this intellectual dead end. They see all of our vices and none of our virtues. They see all the confusions of life, but they do not see civilization. They see all of the absurd, but none of the profound. But here too, in a strange way, the young reflect the concerns of the adult world. How often have you called up a friend and asked that person to be active in a committee for a school, for the scouts, for some political cause, for some citizenship group? And what have you more often than not been told? I'm too busy. I don't want to be involved. 2 Sundays ago, Adele and I and the children were driving along Shaker Boulevard on our way to the temple. We came to the busy intersection at Lee Road. And there, a young boy, 16 years old, who was turning into Lee Road, became confused by the blinking lights and he crashed into us. It was a bad crash, but accidents will happen. But how do you explain the fact that 10 to 12 cars parked on Lee Road waiting for the light to turn, waited for the light to turn, and drove on? Not a one stopped. Not a one offered help. They simply drove on. Where do children learn not to be involved? From you, from your actions, from your priorities, from your conversation. Once upon a time, not so very long ago, the university was a place in which the young person was first confused, deliberately confused as to the values in which he had been raised. The purpose of this original confusion was to broaden his horizons. The confusion was deliberately guided by mature teachers. And then once his horizons had been broadened, his life was guided to a new focus. His energies were marshaled so that his talents might be directed to that which would benefit his society. Today on the modern American campus, the young person brings his own confusions and he leaves with his own confusions. No one has concerned himself with his range of values, but only with his economic role, only with his technological function. That is the shame of the modern American university. And that is the responsibility of the modern American parent. For if we can no longer count upon the surrogate parent, the faculty, to talk philosophy and value seriously and maturely with our young people, we're going to have the courage to do it ourselves. And you know, that's what most parents like to do least. Because we're conscious of our own compromises and of our own failings. We're conscious of all the adjustments which we have made over the years with our own best instincts. We're conscious that our lives have a certain element of hypocrisy in them, what life does not. We're so used to treating our youngsters as youngsters that we forget that at 20 and 21 and 22, they are citizens. They can be citizen soldiers. They are physically fully mature, mentally at the peak of their powers. They deserve honest answers and not to be turned aside with the kind of response we would give to a 10 or 12-year-old. Values remain as where they begin, in the home. And if you cannot expect your young person to broaden his vision on the university, broaden it with him. You'll broaden your own in the process. Let's listen to what these young people have to say. Let's help them to grow beyond criticism, nihilism, the acceptance of the absurd, the absurd. For life is not absurd despite its confusions. There is progress despite the threat of war. True, we are concerned with the slum and the poor, but we're making war on poverty, and the war can be won. Let's teach our young people an elemental truth of our religious tradition, a truth which is repeated again and again in the sacred text, and it is this: Al tifrosh min hatzibur, separate not thyself from the community. It's not only that the lone sheep is picked up by the wolf, it's that the lone sheep becomes wolf, predator, parasite, scavenger. He can't walk alone. He can't walk aside even if he desires to. If there is war, he'll be called to the service and he will die. If there is poverty, his life will be backlashed by the hot anger of the demagogue. If there is racial unrest, he will have a place in the tumult and the shouting. No one can walk alone, neither we nor our children. Al tifrosh min hatzibur, fulfillment, philosophy, a goal. These are communal, shared. These can be found together. Family, faculty, student, adult. Let's help the young people, help ourselves mature into concerned citizenship. Discipline our excess, our greed, our ambition, so that we leave over the best that within us for the society, for those with whom and among whom we live. Let me end as I began. There are 5.5 million Americans in college today. Among these young people, and some not so young, you will find every shade of ability and of attitude. They are getting something less of a college education than you perhaps received a generation ago. Correspondingly, they need more of you. A great challenge has been thrown by this rebellion to the universities. We pray that education will recognize its philosophy as well as economic reality. But we cannot wait for the universities to return to their basic focus. There are 5.5 million young people in college, your sons and your daughters. Their confusions are your responsibility. Their future is in a large measure in your hand. Accept them as adults. Open your mind to them. Do not be afraid of expressing doubt if you doubt, faith if you have faith, virtue if you believe in virtue, tolerance if you are tolerant. Help them to see other human beings and their role and their meaning, your role and your meaning in life. If they can see a single adult whole, they will become wholesome and whole.